The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today John Thorndike. He joins us on the telephone in Athens, Ohio. Hello, John.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
John, you've written a new novel, and I'm curious about this because it's sort of an alternative history. You've taken a real living person and created your own story about this person. And I understand that he is a highly regarded martyr of the Cuban Revolution. How did you decide to write a book about this particular guy? Tell us who he was.
Well, his name is Camilo Cienfuegos, which is where the book gets its name from. 100 fires is Cienfuegos in Spanish. And it's kind of an accident. I'd been reading all about the revolution. I was fascinated by it back in the 60s, and I read, Ernesto Cardenal's book about Cuba, and I read Tad Schultz's biography of Fidel. I read all kinds of things. And I got into this remarkable story of how 82 men had gotten on a boat in the Mexican port town of Tuxpan and had come around to the south shore of Cuba and made an invasion. And of those 82, about 60 of them were killed almost immediately in the first two or three days by the Batista government. And about 15 of them went up into the mountains and 2 years later come down and take over the country. It's a romantic, amazing story. So I was wrapped up in that, and I finally began reading a little bit about one of the characters that I'd never heard of and that almost no one in the U.S., save for around Miami and southern Florida, has heard of, this guy, Camilo Cienfuegos. And I started reading a little bit about him. I was in the middle of writing a book, a novel that was essentially based on a character that was like my mother, and it wasn't working out. And one day I read that this young guy, Camilo, had come up to the United States and had worked around in different places in the country and had been a restaurant worker. He'd worked as an assistant line cook in a New York restaurant, and it just came over me. I thought, this guy could have met my mother. And everything took a turn, and promptly this guy and this woman, who isn't really my mother, but it was kind of based on her for a time, are having this big romance in New York City. And that's how he got into the book.
I'm not sure if you mentioned this point, John. I'm sure our listeners are probably presuming it, but this invasion force that came over from Mexico, they were invading the island of Cuba.
Right.
Okay. And the book
they were led by Castro, who had basically left Cuba. He'd been in jail. They put him in jail. Batista put him in jail and made the great mistake of his life in giving a political release to a number of prisoners, and one of them was Fidel. And he knew he was in danger in Cuba, so he went over to Mexico and put that force together.
The book is 100 Fires in Cuba. John Thorndike wrote it. And the character of Claire, which is an imagined character, you were inspired by your mother. Your mother must have been a very interesting person, or she is a very interesting person to inspire a fictional character. What is it about your mother that you thought would rend itself into fiction?
Well, we probably all think our mothers are vibrant, wonderful people. Not all of us. But many of us were greatly impressed by our mothers. And I had written a book about my dad because my dad came down with Alzheimer's in 2004, 2005, and I went to live with him for a year in Massachusetts. And I wrote a whole book about that. And after I did that, I wanted to write something about my mother, not just to be fair, but just because I was fascinated. The trouble with my mother was that I didn't know. She died in 1972, and everyone who knew her practically is dead, and I have no one to go to, so it had to be a novel. I had to make it up. But that's what led me to, and I'm going to write another one, you know, because Claire in this book, based on my mother, goes off to Cuba, has this other amazing life, and becomes someone entirely different. So the next book will follow my mother's life as closely as I can make it.
Was your previous book before this the one about your dad, the nonfiction?
Right. That was called The Last of His Mind.
Okay. The book is 100 Fires in Cuba. John Thorndike wrote it. He joins us on the program today. I think some of our listeners are familiar with your revolutionary protagonist. I did a little survey downtown. Of course, Yellow Springs is probably the wrong place to do this, but I asked three people if they'd ever heard of this guy, and they all said, oh, yeah, the hero of Cuba's revolution. They've got all kinds of monuments and things to him down in Cuba. He was actually fairly well known. Tell us why he's considered a martyr. I think Che Guevara is probably the most famous martyr of the revolution, but this guy, he's right up there, isn't he?
He is, and I'm amazed by this story and so proud of Yellow Springs. It is the kind of place where someone might know his name, but that's not that common. Three out of three.
Uh-huh.
That's wonderful. Camilo occupies an almost unique position in the great Cuban diaspora and the arguments about Fidel. Because if you go down to Havana, everyone there will tell you what happened to him. He disappeared in a plane. And in Havana, they all say that a storm came up and blew him out to sea. And the plane went down and was never found. In Miami, the great majority of Cuban Americans will tell you that Fidel had him killed because he was of some danger. He was too popular. Because Camilo disappeared the same year that Fidel took over the government in Cuba, which is 1959, because he disappeared, he's almost the only one who is respected equally by both sides. They love him in Cuba, and they honor him in Miami.
Huh. That is unusual.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you decide how to depict Camilo? Because in your book, he comes off as being someone who's fairly naive about politics and about the intrigues of governing.
He was not a politician. He was not that interested in politics. He was a rebel and a fighter and a great believer in eliminating Batista, who had such a bad record in that country. And he was a Fidelista. He would follow Fidel wherever he led. You know, I've done all the research I could do on this. I've read everything I could find, and I cannot come down solidly on one side or the other of whether Fidel Castro had him killed.
Mm.
But he disappeared on that flight, and you know, the arguments fly back and forth on which side, but he is a martyr. He is a martyr in Cuba. And as you say, there are monuments to him all through the country. If you go in the Plaza de la Revolución, you'll see this huge statue. It's kind of an outline of Che Guevara in his famous beret.
Uh-huh.
And right facing the same plaza of equal size is this monument to Camilo. They are roughly of equal stature in Cuba.
Mm-hmm. John, your main character is Claire, the woman who falls in love with Camilo. This is really a love story, but it's much more complicated than that. Set the stage here. Show us, without doing any spoilers, what your story is about.
Well, I said that Claire and Camilo wind up having this affair in New York. They have a 10-week, very passionate affair in New York City. And one day, immigration, La Migra, comes in and arrests Camilo and his roommates and sends them all off to Cuba. So Claire doesn't even know where he's gone. I mean, she assumes he's been sent back to Cuba. She doesn't hear from him. He's just gone from her life overnight. It's a terrible blow. And then just weeks later, she realizes that she's pregnant. And she has that child, and she's still in love with Camilo. She's in love with Cuba, with everything Latin. And she winds up, she's a photographer, and she winds up being sent down to Cuba, when she's eager to go, and to cover the big casinos down there. Mm-hmm. She's doing a photo shoot. And when she's there, she meets another Cuban, an older guy, wealthy, not at all like Camilo, but very nice. He's wonderful with Claire's child, Alameda. And in short, she moves down to Cuba to be with him, and he kind of moves her almost directly into a marriage. She agrees to it. And there she is, married to a different Cuban, when she hears on the radio one day, this is the December of 1958, that two columns are marching east from the mountains. They're marching toward Havana. They're about to take over the government, and they do. But the leader of one of those columns, she hears on the radio, is Camilo Cienfuegos. She didn't think that he was alive. And there we are set up with a very difficult dynamic for her. She's married to a very nice guy whom she kind of loves. But here is the father of her child and her first love alive. And you have this dynamic that Domingo, the older Cuban, is very solid and stable and of the wealthy class that's about to be just run out of the country. And Camilo, a guy of 26 years old, is one of the new leaders of Cuba. And, of course, that's another place where, you know, he's not a politician, nor is he... He knows nothing about families and having a child. And all that is very difficult for him and therefore for her.
I like that. She was listening to the radio in 1958 because you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'll continue my conversation with John Thorndike right after this. I've been joined by John Thorndike. You have a very funny scene in there where Camilo has to change the baby's diapers. This is very fun. Well, it's not totally funny because Camilo kind of freaks out.
He does. He comes back. He comes over to visit Claire. He doesn't like to come very early in the evening. He's just, again, you know, for a while he doesn't even know he has a daughter. And finally, Claire tells him, and then she makes the move to move out of her husband's house, and she invites him over. She'd like him to come over so he can deal with this child of theirs. And Alameda makes him nervous, as small kids can do if you're a father or a man who doesn't know much about children or anything about children. But he goes over one night, and there is Claire just devastated. She has a migraine. And Camilo actually goes out and finds her some medication for that, and he comes back, and then Claire just collapses in bed and says, please, she's wet, change her diaper. And this is, these days I think men are just used to this. You know, I was a single father back in the 70s, and I got used to it pretty quick, but Camilo isn't used to it yet. And the idea that he's going to change the diaper in those days, they're not easy diapers. They're big pieces of cloth you have to put in a triangle. He kind of has that idea. And then he's got to put the pin through there, and that's dangerous. And she's wailing and throwing herself around. And it's a traumatic scene. But if I may give away the ending, you know, she just rages at him, and she can't go see her mother. Her mother has got this horrible migraine, and she just rages and cries, and he gets up and he finds some cold rice and beans in the refrigerator. It's kind of a comfort to him. It reminds him of all the meals that he used to eat uncooked or unwarmed up in the mountains. And then he sits there, and then he hears a little sound, and he goes to the door, and there the girl is lying in bed, and she says, "Usted, you." And he says, "Do you want me to read to you?" And she does. And so begins this great connection between the two of them. Long time coming.
That's not really a spoiler, John. My guess is...
No, that's only a spoiler for that particular scene.
Yeah. My guess is John Thorndike. His book is 100 Fires in Cuba. Okay, you've described our love triangle. We have Camilo, who is the father of this child. We have Claire, who is the woman that Camilo loved and left and doesn't really think about as much as he probably should after he becomes a revolutionary. He's the ultimate revolutionary. And then you have Domingo, the gentleman that Claire has married in Cuba because she thinks Camilo is dead. And they have an interesting relationship. He's a bit older. He loves the little girl like she's his own daughter. And then when Claire finds out that Camilo is still alive, suddenly she's looking at Domingo like, yeah, he's got a lot of money. He's got a beautiful house. He's my husband. But Camilo is like me. He's young. He's attractive. He's sexy, just like me. And here I've got poor Domingo, who's an anti-revolutionary. He's the guy the revolutionaries are going to throw out of Cuba. You've built a lot of tension with this setup, with this trio.
Yeah, Domingo suddenly is on the wrong side of history, at least in Cuba. That he and his compadres, you know, the society that he runs in, are going to either run out of Cuba or they're going to leave. And Claire is looking at someone from the old days or someone who is part of the vibrant new leadership. You know, today Cuba is, frankly, kind of a mess. So are lots of places. But in 1959, the spirit of that country was just so, everyone was so excited. Well, not quite everyone, but the vast majority of people were just filled with hope and gladness that Castro had come in. So, yeah, Domingo is going to be left on the sidelines by history and by Claire as well. It's very difficult for him. And that is, you know, that is so much. You go down to Cuba, which I did only once. I'd like to go again for a longer period. But you find that almost every family in Cuba is split apart effectively by this revolution. You know, they will have members who are in Venezuela or Colombia or Mexico or so many in the United States. And the families are divided, perhaps ideologically, but physically divided. And it's very difficult emotional life for many Cubans because of that, I feel.
John, you just mentioned that Cuba today is kind of a mess, and I'm sure some of our listeners thought to themselves, yeah, well, you could say the same thing about the United States.
Yes.
Yeah.
The difference is that, you know, fewer people here are going hungry, or, you know, we have a lot.
Uh-huh.
It's a mess, but, you know, the level, our level of opulence is, even for the poor, is far above the Cuban poor.
Actually, John, I think opulence is a big part of the problem, but we won't get into that. We're talking about this story, and you've got a nice surprise twist at the end, which I did not expect. I thought that was very clever. It's the kind of thing you'd find in a mystery novel. How did you come up with some of the plotting on this? How did you get these ideas?
I don't know if I can give this away without being the spoiler, but the heart of it was this disappearance by Camilo. I mean, I knew this from the start. It was something that fascinated me. That on October 28th, that's only 10 months into the time that Fidel Castro had taken power of the country, On October 28th, at 6:01 in the evening, all this is very, recorded by people and documented, that Camila took off in a plane. And there's a whole backstory to this. Why was he down in Camagüey? He was flying back to Havana. He took off in that plane, and it was never seen again. It's an overland flight. It's less than 2 hours in a small plane. Mm-hmm. And the plane was never seen. His body was never found. The country ground to a stop. Businesses closed. People were in mourning. I mean, Camilo, after Fidel, and in some ways more than Fidel, because Camilo was more accessible, Camilo was the most loved person in that country. And here, he had disappeared. And Fidel was on the television every day and was flying around in planes. Everyone was looking for him. And that was so dramatic that, well, I started to read everything about it. And when I got the idea of putting Camilo into my book, that actually was a fascination because I thought, one, Camilo isn't that well known in this country. And that gives me a certain liberty. I mean, I cannot change history. You know, I can add to history, but I can't change it. And so effectively, that's what I do. I resolve the question in the book of what happened on that flight. It's much debated, and people will tell you all kinds of things. But I resolve it. And when I heard that he had disappeared and was never found, I thought, this is fabulous for a novelist. You know, after that happens, whatever happens next, he's mine. I can easily add to that without imposing on his actual life.
Oh, you could have gone way further. You could have had him shave his beard and become a star relief pitcher for the Washington Senators if you wanted.
I did have lots of options, and I took another one, as you know, because you've read the book.
My guest is John Thorndike. His novel is 100 Fires in Cuba. You alluded to the fact earlier that you had raised your son in the 70s as a single father. The last time I had you on the program, wasn't that for the book that you wrote about that experience?
Yeah, called Another Way Home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was all about raising Junior, much of it right here in Ohio, down in Athens, Ohio, where I live still. But there was much in there about his mother as well, who was a schizophrenic, and that's how I wound up with him at the age of three.
That was a deeply personal book. Has anything developed in regard to that story since that you want to tell us about? I mean, that
well,
was a long time
only,
ago.
Only the natural functions. You know, there's my son. He lives in Denver. He's married to a fabulous woman. And they have two kids, Harper, who's five, young girl, and Max, who's 11. I just spent Christmas with them, getting utterly exhausted. You know, how did we ever do this when we were younger? How did I ever take care of that boy? But, you know, it seemed simple at the time. But when I go now and look after them, you know, I spend time with my grandchildren, the call, the demands on your attention, constant. it's fabulous, but it's exhausting.
Did Grandpa read them some stories?
Ah, absolutely.
Oh, good.
Although I have to say, regrettably, they're not as interested in books as my son was.
Mm-hmm.
And you know why.
Well, they were too busy looking at their phones?
Yes, a little bit of that.
Yeah.
Harper doesn't have a phone yet, but she has media.
Yeah.
They're big on media.
Videos, games.
They would play. How much would Max play that all day long? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but he does love. His father is a great reader. Janir is a reader. My dad was a reader. I'm a reader. You know, it's just been passed down. And Max reads a lot himself, actually.
Mm. The book is 100 Fires in Cuba. John Thorndike wrote it. He joins us on the program today. He's on the phone in Athens, Ohio. Depicting Fidel must have been interesting as well, because we get the impression that Fidel was a very complicated person, Fidel Castro, And when the revolutionaries come into the city of Havana as conquering heroes, they essentially can do anything they want. Women are throwing themselves at them. And this is one of the problems that's presented to Claire, because all these women want Camilo. In fact, she moves into a dwelling where she meets a landlady who I love that conversation, that first conversation they have. And I know I'm not going to say any more about it, but yeah. It's obvious that Camilo is kind of a sex symbol to all the women in Cuba. And Claire is standing there going, this is my lover. You know, what do I do?
Exactly. And Camilo is, you know, he is a good-hearted guy, but it's hard to be 26 years old, soon to be 27. You've been out in the mountains with almost no contact with women at all. And you come into town and every woman, and yet he is in love with Claire. He was in love with her in New York, and he feels that still. But there's, it's difficult for him because the other options are made available to him all the time. That's another one of the tensions between them.
And her rich husband, Domingo, he's a very nuanced character as well. I think as we're reading the book early on, we don't really want to like him, but it's kind of hard not to like him. He's very complicated.
Yeah. Yeah, he does like to be in control, but he's very subtle about how he does it. And he's wonderful. He's wonderful with Alameda, the 2.5-year-old. He's great with her. And he has become, you know, as I say at one point, she had begun to call him Papa. No one had told her to do that. She just did. And then there's another scene where Claire is going to introduce her to Camilo for the first time. Camilo doesn't even know she exists. And Claire takes Alameda over to Camp Columbia, where Camilo is head of the Cuban army. And she says, it was a painful thing. If Alameda were told that she must change her papa, that's how it would be.
And
how brutal is that?
Truly. And when relationships fall apart, quite often it's the child or the children who suffer the most. And Alameda, it's very nice how you've depicted her. She's, for a 2.5-year-old, she's got a lot going on as a character.
Yeah. She listens. She hears everything, and she's not above manipulating the scene.
Okay, we have just enough time. Tell us about your publisher on this, because there's a local connection here.
Yeah, Beck and Branch. And one of the founders of Beck and Branch is Raul Ramos y Sanchez, who lives over in Beaver Creek, and a wonderful guy who I met at the Ohioana Festival a few years ago, and has got put together this small press, and I was just so happy to publish with him. He is from Cuba originally. He's there right now. Just went down for another visit. He's been visiting in recent years and has met one after another family member, many of whom he didn't even know he had. Mm. And he does just a great job with this little press. And he's published a number of his books there as well. He's got a trilogy of books about a kind of Latin. It's complex, but it's they put all the Latins into a kind of concentration camps in the U.S. or just, you know, roped them all into Los Angeles is what it is. And then he's got a book called The Skinny Years about first coming up to the United States. It's a novel, but it's about first coming up to the United States when he's 8 or so. Wonderful guy, and that it was a great connection for me. Beck and Branch, I love this publisher.
We've had Raul on for those alternative history books and for The Skinny Years.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Right.
John, we really appreciate your time.
I appreciate talking to you. Vic, you're so much fun, and I love your sense of humor.
Thanks, John. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. Don't go away. I have a special treat for you coming up right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO, and I have time to dip into the archive and play you part of an interview that was recorded 21 years ago. The novelist Clive Barker is best known for writing horror fiction. He's very prolific. He hardly ever goes out on book tour. Back in 1998, he came out to see me right here in Yellow Springs. Let's listen now to Clive Barker from the best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook. It's my pleasure to have on the program today Clive Barker. He has a new book out. It's called Galilee. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This book's sort of a departure for you, isn't it?
A little bit, though I sort of view pretty much every book as a departure from the thing before. This is my, including the books that play, is my 19th book. And I've done kids' books, and I've done fantasy, and I've done horror fiction. I did a gay novel, Sacrament, last time up. This is a family saga. The things that they have in common, I guess, is a doubt about consensual reality, which means that there's an element of the fantastic or the strange in all of these books. Though I think there's less of it in Galilee. I mean, Galilee is, I think, perhaps a more mainstream book than others.
Mainstream and a little bit erotic, too.
Yes, that's always important, I think. I think that, actually, we were having this conversation on the way down in the car. The sensuality is underrated, I think, in this culture, which is still, I think, more than tinged with Puritanism and with the sense that the founding fathers were not exactly the most sex positive of individuals. Sensuality becomes this, and sexuality, the erotic life of the body and the mind become guilty pleasures, which very often I think empowers the sleazy folks in the world. I think it empowers the people who want to make a quick buck from our libidos. It empowers the people who live in the dark corners of our cities. I think sexuality, and maybe this is just a tired old liberal thing in me, but you know, I'm a child of the '60s. I love the erotic. I love the celebratory nature of erotic fiction, and this doesn't obviously apply to all my fiction, but certainly I try and find room to celebrate the body and to celebrate the life of the flesh. Very often, the erotic urginess, desire, makes us do things which we would not otherwise do. One of the jobs of my kind of fiction very often is to press my characters into places where they would not often do, where they would do something they wouldn't often do. Rachel, the heroine of Galilee, for instance, falls in love with Galilee, who is a black man of indeterminate origins, at least as far as she's concerned. The reader of the book discovers more than she does, and basically risks her life, her sanity, everything for this man, just as he, in his turn, transforms himself for love of her. And I think it's important when that's the issue at stake and when physicality is so important between these two characters to make sure that I, as the writer, celebrate that physical life. It shouldn't be something that the writer is embarrassed by. It shouldn't be something that the reader is embarrassed by. This is part of our lives.
Well, I certainly didn't mean for anyone to be embarrassed by it.
Vic, I'm sorry. I didn't want to rant about that, but, you know.
This book involves time traveling and involves travel all over to various exotic locales. One of my favorites, the oldest of the Hawaiian islands.
Hawaii.
The Garden Island, I think they call it.
Are you familiar with the island?
I've been there. Beautiful.
It's the most beautiful place in the world. And the author photograph was taken by David, who's my significant other, my lover, on the beach where Galilee and Rachel walk in the book. We regularly go to a house, the same house in Kauai, and watch the whales breaching. And I wanted to celebrate the physical beauty of the island in the book. And so the book certainly ranges over a number of places, but Kauai is the paradise garden in this particular version.
Right there off the coast of Napali, off of Honolulu.
Sure.
I've seen whales breach there in the spring. It's an amazing thing.
It's not to be believed. You stand on the beach there and here are these gorgeous, you know, things, humpback whales just breaching. And this is an interesting thing for me about writing the kind of fiction that I write, which strays very often into the metaphysical, because I think so often supernatural fiction, that's one of the responsibilities of supernatural fiction, is that it stray off into the spiritual or the metaphysical. Paradoxically, that also brings you back to reality, because it brings you back to maybe a different kind of reality to the one that the reader first encounters when he picks up the book, or she picks up the book. Part of the journey of a book like Galilee is hopefully through the fantastic elements into a deeper understanding of the real world. The great models for these kinds of fiction, I'll instance two that, you know, everybody knows, Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest, both of which are works of fantasy, of course, magic in the case of Prospero's Island and fairies in the case of Midsummer Night's Dream. These stories are used, and these ideas are used, and these fantasies are used to make us more fully understand who we are as human beings and how miraculous the world is. In other words, the fantasy is not used as an escape from the world, but as a tool to more deeply comprehend the world we're actually in. And I think that's something that's a perception which is sometimes missing in the way that we view this kind of material. So often you say the word fantasy to people, and they sort of, they think of Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, nothing wrong with that, a wonderful book, but an escapist book, essentially. A book which is in which you sort of unplug the world and you go to a place with little men with hairy feet, in which sexuality, for instance, never raises its head. In fact, women are scarcely to be seen except as objects of remote adulation. In which the battle between good and evil is incredibly clear. There's no moral ambiguity, and in which the physical life of the place is very remote from our own physical lives. And that's the way I think many people think of fantasy. But I think the older tradition of fantasy would go back to Beowulf in the English tradition, to myth and legend. That tradition is actually a tradition of understanding of the real world. It's about comprehension of the real world. Joseph Campbell points this out for the first time in my experience in his writings about anthropological studies of mythology, in which he's basically saying, look, these stories are about the world. They may be about divinities and deities and shamanistic experiences, but they're actually about the world, and they're about human, very human issues. I would like to think that I partake of that tradition, the tradition in which you use fantasy and the world of the imagination to help the reader reconfigure their own consciousness in relation to the real world.
Clive Barker has joined us, and Clive has a new book out. It's called Galilee. It's published by HarperCollins, and this book focuses on two families. Mm-hmm. The one family reminded me a lot of the Kennedys.
Oh, I don't know why you would say that.
The one character, was it Cadmus?
Yes.
He seemed a lot like Joe Kennedy.
He's very like Joe Kennedy, mm-hmm. No question. I mean, what was interesting was, and the reason I'm making the joke about I don't know why you would say that is because, you know, I have to be a little careful here. In my study of the big American families, the big, rich American families, none of them, of course, originally American, though very few of us are, I discovered commonalities, a great braveness of spirit, often a great physical beauty, often a profound moral corruption, often great tragedy. And so in constructing the Geary family in Galilee, yes, I partook of the Kennedys, but I actually partook of the Astors and the Carnegies and the Gettys, actually. I mean, Cadmus is... Cadmus, yes, there's Joe Kennedy in there, but there's also a little Paul Getty Sr. Cadmus is perhaps more villainous than either of those two men, but like those two men, he's incredibly secretive about his villainy. And it's only towards the very end of the book that we really discover how profoundly corrupt this man is. By contrast with the Gearys, the other family, the Barbarossas, are racially mixed, sexually diverse, extremely diverse. Galilee sister is, her name is Marietta. She's actually one of the most fun characters that I've ever had to write. She's a very lively, very self-opinionated lesbian who gives the first-person narrator of the book, Maddox, who is essentially yours truly, the hardest time commenting about picking up the pages of the book, as it were, that the Maddox is writing and saying, you know, I don't really approve of this stuff. Marietta was great fun. Galilee has a streak of bisexuality in him. Lumen, his half-brother, his brother rather, is a crazy adventurer of another color. So there's a sense, I think, that the Barbarossas represent a very different kind of energy in the American scene to the Gearys, and hopefully there's a sort of sense that if the Gearys are the essentially secular, acquisitive side of American nature, the Barbarossas represent the spiritual, magical side. Going back to the issue of eroticism again, the Barbarossas are much more at peace with their erotic natures than the Gearys are. I don't want to give too much away, but the eldest son of the Geary family probably indulges in one of the most perverse sexual acts I've ever described on the page. It's all described rather discreetly, I hasten to add, but nevertheless it's there to be found.
I think I know of what you speak.
Also, the point got across there. So the contrast between the families is central to the book. And Rachel, the heroine of the book, marrying an Ohio girl, into this rich, prestigious, influential family, almost by chance, really. She's a working-class girl, blue-collar girl, marries into, you know, money.
In Boston,
exactly. Well, no, there's no error in any of this, you know. There's a pattern here. And then discovering that not only does this family have extraordinary secrets, but that they're tied in with this other family, this North Carolina family, who live in a house nobody can ever find, built by Jefferson, along the Monticello model. And that the prodigal son of this family, Galilee, is this extraordinary, brooding, sad, romantic man who sails around the world on a boat, very seldom stepping foot on land, but irregularly doing so on a beach in Kauai, there to make love to a Geary woman of each generation. It's a very romantic idea, I think.
What were you like when you were little?
Good question. I was a pretty sad little kid, I think. I was brought up in the 50s. I'm 45 now, in post-war Liverpool in England, which is a pretty melancholy place. It had been badly bombed during the Second World War. It didn't recover very quickly. There was still rationing around when I was a kid. Very loving parents, not a lot of money, no television, none of those distractions. Books, of course. Always books from the library. But a sense for me from very early on that this was not a life that I was made for. I'm talking about life in Liverpool and, you know, my dad worked on the docks. Sort of blue-collar, Liverpool was not really my thing. Very powerful women in my family on both sides. My grandmother is 100 this year, and she's Italian. I'm Italian-Irish, which is a typical Liverpoolian mix. And she's 100 this year, forceful woman, very forceful woman. My mother, her daughter, the same. My father's mother, the same. I think it's one of the reasons why, over and over again in the books, certainly Galilee is a good example, at the heart of the story. And this is true of the Kennedys, just going back to one of the great American families again, are women. The public faces of the family may be male, but without the Ethels and the Roses, in the book, in Galilee, without the Cesarias and the Lorettas and the various other, and the Rachels, the incredibly powerful, self-willed women who survive the traumas of the male ego. life would not exist as it does. Success would not be available to the male without the woman being there to tend the wounds and to support them in their vanities. That's an important perception for me because it was my experience as a child. Now I look back on it, I think it was of its time to some extent. Though I'm interested, when I write about the rise of the goddesses, which I write about a lot in a book called A Magica, that was actually the real subject of the book, was the overthrowing of a patriarchal system of godhood in favor of something more benign and wise. And I don't want to get sentimental about this because I don't think the true vision of the goddesses is sentimental at all. Strong and dangerous at the same time as being wise and benign. So that's a story I tell often. In these narratives, I am reflecting a sort of sense of my own family that the men got around about their business and did reasonably well in the world, but the women were the ones who really held the reins.
You have been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 1998 interview with Clive Barker. He actually came out to Yellow Springs to record that for his novel Galilee. And I didn't realize until recently what a rare thing it was to have him come through on book tour. I was chatting online with the novelist Ian Rankin, and he was talking about how he had a signed copy of Galilee by Clive Barker. Apparently he was touring through Scotland that same year. And he said, yeah, he drew a really neat piece of art inside the book. And I thought, I need to go look at my copy. And I remembered when I did that when Clive Barker came through, he was on a really tight schedule. We had a short interview that day because he supposedly had to go somewhere. And then I asked him to sign my book. And he spent about 15 minutes drawing an illustration with his autograph, which is pretty cool to have. Barker is best known for writing horror fantasy. He began writing horror early in his career, mostly in the form of short stories. His books of blood were first published in the U.S. in paperback, volumes 1-6. Stephen King was quoted on the book covers. I have seen the future of horror, and his name is Clive Barker. As influences on his writing, Barker lists Herman Melville, Edgar Allan Poe, Ray Bradbury, William S. Burroughs, William Blake, and Jean Cocteau. You heard it on the Book Nook, my only interview with Clive Barker. Tune in tomorrow at 10:30 on Sunday morning when Tim Johnston returns to the program. He's got an amazing new thriller that just came out this week. It's called The Current. I'll talk to Tim Johnston about it. It's a murder mystery, a thriller, and it's set in the cold of winter in Iowa and Minnesota. That's tomorrow on the Book Nook at 10:30 right here on WYSO. Tim Johnston talking about The Current. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.